The Metal Mentality Podcast is brought to you in partnership with AM300 and the Phoenix Project. For more information on both, check out am300.com/metal.
It's time for you to be the you that you know you can be and define your metal. My name is Preston Yule, and I'm the host of the Metal Mentality Podcast. I'm a husband, a father, and American soldier. What is metal? It's your strength of character that you rely on to endure hardship. It's your grit. Together, we'll learn from some dedicated, passionate, metal-minded individuals who define themselves by their grit and their graduation from suffering. Be metal. Stay metal.
Welcome to the show, everybody. This is Metal Mentality. I am your host, Preston Yule. Today, I am joined by Major Retired Jesse Stewart. Jesse, how are you tonight?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I really appreciate you taking the time to share your story with us. As we've been talking over the past couple of weeks, I am enthralled by it, and I can't wait to delve into a little bit deeper. So why don't you go ahead and why don't you tell us just a little bit about yourself? Let's unpack who you are outside of the uniform and just who you are right now. How would you define yourself?
First of all, I thought you were going to say outside of Instagram. I'm like, oh, I'm screwed. I can't do that. So I retired from the Army. I took the uniform off in 2012, and it was a sudden retirement through a medical retirement. I had my fourth reconstructive knee surgery in 4 years and was forced into retirement. And so it was like, bang, I thought I was going to be doing another 20 to 30 years with the people's son next to me, Ryan Bell. But my career was over. And so at the time, everyone assumed that I was okay. And I'd gotten a couple master's degrees while I was on active duty. And so I went straight into the civilian world. No screening or transition or any of that stuff. And obviously we haven't even began to unpack the baggage that I had from my deployments and then from some stuff that happened back stateside. And so I went into the civilian world and worked for initially Corning, a company, large multi-billion dollar company. And let's just say that I had a problem. Well, I didn't think I had a problem. The people that I worked for had a problem with staying at the companies that I came to. And after a couple of years, the first three bosses that I had that had worked for the company for years had left the company. And all three of them had claimed that it was because of me. And my CEO at the time was a former West Point guy. It was a tanker, so it wasn't in the special operations or ranger community. And so I'm not going to lie, he let me get away with murder. And I remember the first guy when he quit and he told me why, I was like, crap, I'm going to get in trouble. And I go in and literally the boss goes, he literally says, I guess that's just, clearing out the weeds. And unfortunately for me, what that did was that just reiterated my behavior. And so after it happened the second time, I started kind of trying to reassess what's going on. And I also started teaching at Grand Canyon University and their leadership school. And so I'm teaching leadership and I'm definitely not exhibiting at the company. And so I ended up eventually deciding to start the path towards owning my own company because honestly didn't want to hurt people. I didn't want to make people uncomfortable. And the guy back here is kind of laughing at me. He's like, what are you talking about? You love that stuff. I actually don't. And that was the main driver behind that. And so I came up with an idea for patent and RFID tracking technology and got it approved and support behind the government. And right as soon as I launched, my wife's time filed for divorce. And that proceeded into a very, very ugly divorce, which actually is how I met people. I became close with people next to me. And Richard came on. He tried to help me with keeping the company alive. And, we probably could have done it, honestly. Much to Miss Sherry's dismay. Probably could have done it, but there was a reason why the universe allowed it to kind of fizzle away. And that's because obviously what transitioned into it now is a result of that. We got some pretty bad thunder in the background. I don't know if you heard that or not.
No, I didn't.
So my dog starts yelping. That's what it is. Anyway, I try to maintain it as long as I could. And, at that point I pretty much isolated myself from everyone. So it was about 3.5 years ago, everyone except for Richard Bell and his wife.
Speaking of Richard Bell and his wife, why don't you go ahead and introduce them to us? I know they're there with you. You felt that it was important that they were here with you. And introduce them and tell us why they are important to you.
Yeah, so
I thought I could make a lot of money from Jesse, so that's why I helped him.
Initially, with the RFID technology, not this stuff. So Richard and Sherry are my spiritual parents. Miss Sherry is about the closest thing. She is the closest thing I have to a mother. And Richard is definitely a second father. My father and I were real close. Paul Stewart, retired Navy Master Chief. They're my family. And about 8 or 9 months ago, Richard decided he was going to get old and almost die. And so I ended up coming down here to spend a little bit of time to help out initially. And then I realized all of a sudden that I wasn't hating people as much as I normally do down here as I do everywhere else. And so I decided to just stay because the people don't piss me off as much. And Miss Sherry is awesome. So
yeah, that's a big deal. I mean, she loves family. Family's important, right? So why are they, tell me about I don't even know where to start with this because there's so much you've told me about them and I feel like I know them a little bit, but why you asked that they be here today for this recording, and I'd like to ask you why you feel like that was important and share with us the role that they've had in your life that in order for you to share your story today, you feel that they needed to be here.
Yeah. So this whole story doesn't happen without these two people in my life. Take them out and it stops about 3 years ago. In fact, I'm probably dead. Had Richard not come up to Colorado Springs when he did, when the divorce first started, his son had called him because I was given advice from an attorney, you know, hey, you need to stay away from all your friends that are in special operations. And at the time, those were the only people I trusted. And so I had no one and I was completely isolated. And so Ryan, Richard's son, had called him. And Richard and I had met a couple times before. We met, I think, at Ranger School when I graduated in 2003. And then we met at Fort Bragg when I came back from 2004 deployment. And then the big time of us meeting was when I hit their future daughter-in-law very hard on the buttocks with a sword when I was the sword-bearing leader party. And she's she was going in the Army as a doctor and she should have known it was coming. So I probably gave her a little more firm of a smack than most people do. And they say, welcome to the Army, ma'am. And so I think that's probably how I became known by the Bell family. And their daughter-in-law, Adrienne, still remembers it to this day very well and hasn't forgiven me. And so that was 2005-06. Fast forward to 2016 is when Ryan had asked Richard to come up there. And I didn't remember Richard, barely. And he just shows up at the airport and he's there. And I'm like, all right, thanks, I guess. And he's like, all right, let's see what's going on. And you know, for the next couple of weeks, he was by my side. And had he not been there, I the chances of doing something stupid would have been dramatically higher. But more importantly, like he was able to slow down my combustion enough for me to realize that there was a purpose, for my life and for my journey. Because even when him and I were doing the RFID stuff and we had some awesome opportunities, you know, we're up in this, find ourselves in the office of the superintendent of West Point, trying to figure out how to keep him kids from running off the base by putting these little bracelets on them and, you know, going to the Pentagon and going to New York City and RFID facilities in Alabama. Like Richard, you know, he always had my back. And that was what was unusual because with me, especially the way my career worked, where I had progressed a little differently than most and I just never had peers, I never had anyone to watch my back. Never had anyone as a kid, never had anyone in my military career. And then when I became a civilian, I didn't trust civilians. And so, which is wrong. And so when I met Richard, he was the first one that I could honestly be comfortable and could let my guard down. And so when I was in meetings, I could hyper-focus on the task at hand and we could do some good things because I was able to do that when he was with me. When he wasn't, I was a hot mess. And so pretty much at that point, you know, we started spending, you know, as much time as we could get in. It was a convoluted, you know, babysitter role / Richard wondering what adventure was going to come up next / you know, what is actually going to happen with this? Because it was a cool idea. You know, idea was never another American POW again. And, and we had it figured out. But unfortunately, my divorce just was absolutely debilitating to me. And Richard was there, though, I think just to slow down life enough for me to see, to get a glimpse of what my purpose was. And so when 2017 came along, some things had happened. Like Richard, I mean, Sherry probably said something to me, but Richard never did, about, you know, some of my behavior, my destructive behavior, my isolating behavior. And something had happened, and these were kind of the one people in my life that I felt like I'd never let down, and they had never let me down for sure. And so there were a couple of incidences where, you know, I let them down. And I hate that. And when I realized that I had let them down, like, I was devastated. And I was like, I gotta fix this. And the feelings of pain and agony that I had over that were pretty close to losing guys on the battlefield. And so at that point, I'm also losing, I've got close to the number of suicides from my unit that I served with, which was 14, that I lost in 2007 under my command. And so I started talking to Richard about, hey, I need to figure this out. Because if I don't, there's not going to be any guys left in my unit. And that's the only thing I'm proud of, my military service. And I'm eventually going to probably end up becoming one of the statistics. And you know, as an officer, generally no one really cares, you know, what you're doing. You're going to be responsible. You're the alleged grown-up, right? Alleged, the key word there. Mm-hmm. And so Richard and Sherry provided protection long enough for me to see what I needed to do and that I needed to do it for myself, because they were also the ones that wanted me to do it for myself before everybody else was like, you need to do it for everybody else in the world, your daughters, your ex-wife, you know, your family, whatever. And they were the only ones that were really saying, hey, you know, do this for yourself because we love you and we want you to be better. And so, you know, that's why I say the catalyst for making the decision and the initial motivation for doing it was essentially not to let them down. And so, you know, when I went to the VA in Grand Island, Nebraska, and I show up there, and I think Richard even offered to bring me up, and I did not take him up on it because I was scared how like low I'd gone, and I'd end up volunteering to go to the lowest rated VA in the country, because it was easiest to get into. And, you know, I show up there, and at this point, I'm still not willing to admit that I've got a quote unquote substance problem. I just knew there was something that was causing me to use substances that I had to check out. So anyway, I ended up going there to the VA, and that's when the journey of the Phoenix Project ended up starting. So that brings us to here. So I've had a few experiences life-wise. College professor, managed some business stuff, and served as an Army officer, and then now run AM300.
Yeah, so as we've talked over the past couple of weeks, I told a couple of people I was going to be interviewing you tonight, and I said he's probably the most interesting man in the world. He's like the Dos Equis guy. But I want to thank you, Richard.
He's my favorite actor, by the way. He's actually my favorite actor.
Is he?
Yeah.
He does a good job, that guy, right? Well, yeah. So, Richard, thank you so much for, you know, getting Jesse to a point where he can share this story with us. I just want to say thank you, because just from what I've heard of it already, my life has been so impacted.
Difficult situation at best, but I did my best.
And it was enough. So, yeah, before we unpack your whole story, I do want to ask you a couple other questions. And the first one is, who would win in a three-way arm wrestle between you, me, and Chuck Norris?
Oh, well, that's easy. I mean, I would just get on Chuck Norris's team and we go both against you.
Well, false. I've beat Chuck Norris already once. So if I can beat him, I can beat you and him. So that's my answer.
Not possible. Okay.
No.
Well, agree to agree with me.
That's what I feel like is going to happen all night. I'm just joking. But another question I want to ask you is, how many ducks do you think it would take to kill a rhino?
How many ducks to kill a rhino?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, are these ducks that are weaponized?
Do you have the technology to weaponize them?
Oh, you can weaponize anything, my friend.
Okay.
Be creative over there in Iraq. Trust me. We put grenades on predators or shadow little UAVs and called in our own fires.
So your answer is probably going to be one then, right? You're
put a help. Yeah, I mean, you go to the right spot in the eye.
There you go. That was not the answer I expected. That I should have expected the unexpected with you.
Go for the weakness.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, let's get into it. Seriously, why don't you go ahead and unpack your story for us? Tell us about your book that's coming out, The Phoenix Project, and what you would like to share about that, which you think would be beneficial for those listening to today.
The Phoenix Project concept, you know, came from when I was up at in Grand Island, and we'll come back to that. But the concept of the Phoenix Project, you know, obviously, or the Phoenix bird is the, you know, the bird that once it reaches its culmination in life, it burns down into a ball of flames. And then out of the ashes of good rises something better. And it continually does this cycle of life until it reaches, you know, perfection. And so that Greek mythology story, it always kind of resonated with me and it made sense. And so I remember studying about it in high school and, you know, fast forward, it was influential for the rest of my life. But the reason why my childhood, I think, is relevant is that, you know, I had some interesting things that happened when I was a kid, when I was in high school, when I was in the Army, and as a semi-adult. And I can honestly say that what I went through as a child, you know, prepared me for what I was going to go through in war. And what I went through in war prepared me to lose a child. And that prepared me to lose, you know, my family as I knew it at the time. And allowed me to get to the point that I could initiate the Phoenix Project. Because for me, up until that point, my entire life and identity was wrapped around being something. In my case, it was being an Army Ranger. And even after, so when I retired, that being taken away from me was huge. And that's why when I work with the athletes I've worked with US Ski and Snowboard, I always ask them, I say, listen, are you Lucas Foster who happens to snowboard, or are you the snowboarder named Lucas Foster? Because I was a ranger named Jesse Stewart. And so when that was taken away from me, it was debilitating. So grew up in an interesting you know, situation. My parents got divorced when I was five. Right before that was my first traumatic memory I remember, which was being at the Challenger space shuttle when it launched. And I was at the Challenger space shuttle when I was 5 years old, and I watched it blow up right in my face. And I remember everybody freaking out, but we got in a class on how high they were and where they were. I'm like, well, why are we freaking out? There's nothing. I mean, it sucks what happened up there. My poor grandma is there as a chaperone, like freaking out because her grandson's the only one not losing his crap. And so that happens. And then next thing I know, my parents tell us that they're going to divorce and we move up to Washington State. And so my mother moved us up there. My mother, unbeknownst to me at the time, it had my dad pretty much kept away from us. And so for the first 4 or 5 years, didn't really see him. And my mother started bringing some, you know, steady dose of boyfriends that were not the nicest guys. And then she ended up marrying the worst of them when I was 11 years old, my first stepdad. And he was the guy that taught me how to take a punch and get back up at a young age. So my mother marries this guy, and I was just a real hard-nosed kid. I did not like to quit from the very beginning. And, you know, him, you know, beat me down. I was kind of want to stay down, stay down, stay down. And I wouldn't stay down. And this just led to a, you know, very rough relationship with him and I. And this lasted up until I was about 14 years old when I got to high school. And keep in mind, I went to 9 different schools from kindergarten to 9th grade. Every year switch schools. And so I finally get to high school. No one knows who I am. And I wanted to be on a varsity sport because there were no freshmen that were varsity athletes. And so for wrestling, you could challenge 10 pounds above your weight, or you could 10 pounds down the class. So if I could cut down to 111 pounds, I could challenge the 101 pounders, and all the 101 pounders weigh like 80 pounds. So if I went at 110 pounds, I could just lay on them and win and at least get to the varsity match, right? So I gained, so I cut down to 110, and then it would suck for the next 3 days. And so I did that, and I made it on varsity. I was only a freshman. And I went out there and started the season for us. And the guy I was wrestling was this, you know, senior man child that weighed 101 pounds, and I think he got third in state the year before. And I went out there, and wrestling was big in our town, probably about 5,000 people in this arena. And I go out and everyone's expecting me to get my butt handed to me. And what I did was I took all the anger, rage, and resentment I had had built up in my life for the first 14 years and imagined my stepdad's face on that kid. And when that ref blew the whistle, I pounced. Somehow timed it, ended up pinning him in 2 seconds. And wow. When I heard the roar of 5,000 people cheering for me, I realized I have found the key to life. Just win. And everyone will leave you alone. Because once that happened, I mean, there's probably some people that saw I mauled that kid and, you know, like, oh, we're going to keep our space from him. But that's what winning did for me, is it isolated me. And I very quickly realized that that's how I could protect myself, was by isolating and, you know, just finding ways to be different.
In what way did that isolate you? Because it seems like it might have the opposite effect for some people. But when you say isolated, what did you mean by that?
So I had a counter to that. So when I made it on the varsity, I was the only, I realized quickly there were no smart kids in sports really in my school. And so I made it a goal to get in the smart, the AP classes. And I did not test in the AP classes. And how I made it in is an interesting story in itself, but not appropriate in what I necessarily want my daughters to eventually be able to find. But let's just say that I got creative not having the test scores. And so I got into the AP classes, and when I got in there, I was the only athlete. And so, you know, none of the smart kids wanted to deal with me. And then with my athlete friends, they're like, oh, all of a sudden Jesse's smart. And it just created another buffer of standoffness that I was able to achieve. And so in the classes, I struggled because these kids were smart. Like, they would have 100 facts available to them, and I would only have 3. But I realized very quickly, like, okay, if they're rummaging through their fact base of 100 things, that's going to take time. And if I just dive deep down in on these 2 or 3 things, so deep that they have to follow me and they don't necessarily know where they're going when they do, then I can beat them at any argument that they come to me with. And so that was how I attacked smart classes and ended up doing well enough to get enough AP classes to initially be able to graduate with 2 degrees from the University of Washington. So for me, it was always about just being different, finding ways to be different so I could have standoff. It wasn't about being popular. It wasn't about getting friends. It was about creating space between me and everybody else.
So the space was kind of a coping tool for you, would you say? A coping mechanism?
Yeah, if no one's close enough to me, they can't hurt me.
That makes sense. Yeah, I can see that. So what happened after? So you graduated, you beat this kid at wrestling, right? Like, you get to college, and then what happened? What happened when you went to college?
Well, so I played sports, baseball, football, wrestling, and then went to college and was initially going the baseball route. And my mother got sick, and so I ended up staying at the University of Washington and just doing ROTC. I had to do the ROTC program. And so I went there and was looking to transfer West Point the second year, but I ended up just staying because my battalion commander for ROTC had gone to West Point. He's like, Jesse, if you go transfer there, you're going to start over as a freshman. You're kicked out. So I ended up staying. And fast forward my senior year, I'm in New York, visit my aunt and uncle, live in New York. And so on September 10th, we went up to have brunch at the top of the World Trade Center on September 10th, 2001. And had lunch or brunch, and then I flew back to the University of Washington. And next morning, I was in the weight room working out, 5:15-ish in the morning, whatever it was, and watched those same towers that I just ate brunch in fall. And that was starting my senior year. And so I ended up,
So how did that affect you?
Oh, I was pissed because my aunt and uncle lived like right across the way from them in Brooklyn Heights. Like, they went after my family. And you know, back in those times, that was when like everybody in ROTC wanted to be in infantry and wanted to be a ranger. And there were probably 30 guys that wanted to do it. And there's 4 or 5 of us after that. So it made it a little more real. So I actually had the picture right back there behind me of on top of that World Trade Center. I mean, it didn't scare me or anything. It focused me more. And the problem with ROTC is that, you know, you have to wait for all the West Pointers to get your choices. And the only way that you can guarantee you get what you want is if you finish in the top cadet in the nation. Mm-hmm. Otherwise,
That was your goal. That's what you said. Like, I will be the top. I'm going to win. I win out no matter what, because if I win, I'm different.
The goal was to be an infantry officer and become a Ranger. Well, that meant I had to get infantry. The only way I could be guaranteed to get infantry was to finish at the top. So
you did that, right?
I did.
Yeah. Wow. So then after you commissioned, what point did you go to Ranger school? And then
so I got commissioned in 2002. So Ryan and I got commissioned together. He actually went to the Air Force Academy, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. So he somehow got in past the colorblind test. Who knows how, but he's colorblind. And right for senior year physical to become a pilot, he failed the colorblind test. And so he was able to branch transfer with a West Point cadet and got into the infantry. So we met at the infantry officer basic school, which is where you go first. And then shortly after that, I went to Army Ranger School with Ryan and then went through that. Was fortunate enough to get straight through, which is not a skill at all. It's pure luck. That school, you just don't quit. And but I still got my butt kicked. I mean, I went in at about 200 pounds and left at 150 pounds. And I still will say that, you know, that school taught me something that I would have never gotten anywhere else. And I still use in life today. And that's where my real cut line is, like when I'm going to quit physically and mentally. Like I would have thought when I went to Ranger school, it's like a 5 on a scale of 1 to 10. Well, when I was in Ranger school, I learned it was really like an 8. And so that's what that gave me. So Ryan and I went through infantry officer basic course, Ranger school together, and we ended up going to our first unit together and deployed together to Iraq in the first part of the invasion or first part of the war in 2003 together. The major thing that happened was me going into command. Like, so once again, back to having to do it differently. So when you go, when you're an officer, you're supposed to take a break at 3 or 4 year mark. You go to the captain's career course, you take a break, you go to a different unit, and you take command. I did not leave my unit. I stayed there, and I took command when I was 26 years old within Charlie Troop of Task Force 300. And what made that worse of a situation, not worse, but created more problems for me was the other commanders in the unit had already done a line command somewhere else. This was the second command for them. It was considered a bonus. And so I took command. And when I went in there, so Ryan, for instance, he went on to the Marine Corps command or Marine Corps Captain Career Course, whatever. Very smart move on his end. You know, got a good break, sustainable career. I went into command while he was doing that. And so I go into command in Bakuba, Iraq in 2007, which is right when everything was about to kick off. And because I had been the planner for the task force, and it studied the Diyala River Valley, I was the first company to go in there, and we went in there, and that was where ISIS had ended up setting up its de facto government in Bakuba, and we ended up slugging it out with them for about 9 months, and I ended up losing 14 of my guys under my command. I was wounded 3 times myself, and it was rough. And during that time, up until that point, I didn't really drink. And the day that I lost 9 guys, I went to the doctor. So on April 7th, I think, we lost 9 guys in 1 day. And man, my heart was about to just crush. I was devastated. Mm-hmm. And I went to the doctor and I said, hey, Bob, I need to talk to somebody, man. This is not normal. I'm like 5 years younger than any other commander here. And I've just set the record for the most loss in 1 day for the war. And he said, Jesse, if you go talk to anybody, you're going to lose your command, you're going to lose your security clearance, and you'll never lead Rangers again. And so he gave me a bottle of blue pills, which was Xanax. And that was what helped keep those emotions suppressed. And so I continued the deployment, and I ended up getting rated very high through that deployment. And shortly after I was about to finally go, I ended up hitting a promotion for a major early 2 years, but I wasn't even eligible for it because I hadn't gone to the career course, but somehow made it. And so they just let me go on to Command and General Staff College after I finished my 3rd year command. And once I got there, I had my 3rd reconstructive knee surgery and then 4th, and then lost my child. And then my career, you know, went into the retirement. And so we already kind of briefly talked about the other stuff that drove me up to VA. So fast forwarding to that, at this point, I started doing some work with US Ski and Snowboard. So I was already doing some work with them. They'd invited me out as a random Purple Heart Ranger that they just wanted to come out and speak to their rookies. And when I showed up, they thought I was going to be in like a wheelchair and on crutches. And I'm like, no, we're working out. And so because I went in there and they had the assumption and I worked out with them, you know, they kept inviting me back. And so that was kind of an off the side thing. And so what I would talk to them about there was living life on the mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual planes of existence. Because I would say, hey, listen, one of my big problems was I relied solely on the physical. Because in our community, it's all about how physically fit you are. I mean, you can be the smartest officer in Fort Bragg or a Ranger Battalion or anything. If you're overweight, you're done. You're toast. You're not having a chance. Which is not, like, there's some great officers that have some great ideas that never get a voice at that table because of that culture. And so I told these athletes, I say, listen, I wish that I would have been more balanced on these other planes of existence, because if I had, I would have been able to bounce back from the trauma better. And so when I get to the VA, I will never say that I hit rock bottom, because a guy like me was issued a jackhammer at birth. So any rock bottom that I may experience, I've got the capacity to go about 20 feet further, right? And so I get there and things are sucking though. And so I show up and I think the average person there had been there 3 times already. I was the only person that had just been there my first time. Wow. And I was like, what have I got myself into? Like, I came here to try and figure stuff out. And so I locked myself in a classroom and just frustrated, because I needed a plan of some sort. And so I sat there waiting to meet with my therapist, and there's a whiteboard and some markers. And so I picked them up and I thought to myself, I'm like, okay, you know, this VA way is not going to work for me. I'm not going to work well with a VA person telling me what to do with my quote unquote recovery, you know, whether it be from PTSD, substance use, or whatever. You know, I can't see an AA way working for me because I don't trust those people and never served. And then the workout way or CrossFit way, and I could get away with drinking a fifth of Jack a day a night before and then go work out with Olympic athletes. So I could get away with that. And then on the spiritual side, that was the one I always kind of felt a little bad about, because it's like, why isn't my faith enough to kind of carry me through? And what I came to the realization was, it's because the faith is something that, you know, is intertwined, you know, between, you know, everything. And so, so I get in this room and I said, write down those 4 words. And I'm like, you know what? Maybe there's a way I can use the resources from everyone else to create my own little plan here. And so I started writing down, I wrote down the 4 words, mental, emotional, physical, spiritual, and I wrote down all the resources that I had on there. And so for about 3 hours, I wrote, and that whole whiteboard was full by the time I was done with it, almost. And so I remember sitting back there and I'm like looking at it and I'm holding my hand up, covering up one of the words that I'd written up there. And when I pulled my hand down, it was the emotional. It was what I could not write a single resource under, because I had perfected the art of isolating from the time that I was a little boy and I had nothing. And so the only thing that I knew that I hated worse than alcohol and or PTSD was white space on a calendar or a whiteboard or anything. And so I had to write something. And so I, looking at the board, I'm like, well, I can't leave. I've got to write something. And so I remember one of the guys complaining about how we're going to have to go to AA meetings every night we were there. And so I thought to myself, I'm like, what if I go and meet one guy every night and go be his friend, listen to him complain, whatever, like, how about I'll do that? And that'll be my emotional plane. And so I made a deal with this whiteboard that if I could write that down there, then I would do that. And so I went up to the whiteboard and I wrote 12 steps under the emotional. And as soon as I did that, you know, I never messed around with psychedelics. And so I don't know how that stuff works, but I had what can only be described as a psychedelic vision right in front of me of a phoenix bird coming right up in my face. And I'm simultaneously watching all the things that I at least perceive success in my life. You know, university degree, being an Army Ranger, company commander, promotions, et cetera. making Richard Bell happy. So just like all these things that I saw. And so I'm watching him come up with the Phoenix Bird. And like, these were the only things I had in my life. I mean, I had nothing else other than those achievements. And then all of a sudden, everything blew up in a ball of fire right in front of my face. And I was like, whoa, holy smokes. And I remember feeling like devastated. Like, it was a vision. It wasn't even real, but I was so devastated as I watched it happen. And then all of a sudden, out of those ashes started rising something way more beautiful than I had just seen in initially with that Phoenix bird, and didn't even care about my stuff, like what I watched come out of there. And so that happened. And that was when I realized, okay, this is what I got to do. I've got to embrace this concept of the Phoenix Project, and we'll see what happens. And so I did. And ever since then, I've been going, I've been going progressively better. And like, for me, what it's been about is finding out more and more about myself. So for example, I had come to the conclusion that I was an alcoholic about 2 weeks into that program there. But I then realized that alcohol wasn't necessarily my problem. Alcohol was a solution for me. I mean, it was an ability to shut down emotions and feelings. But for me, it was something else. So I assumed, okay, well, it's like the PTSD. And, you know, the alcohol is just suppressing the PTSD. So it's like a pressure cooker. But I would start working on the PTSD, but there was still this like feeling of something not being right that caused me to want to drink. And when I do work with guys, you know, I always encourage them to look at what is the problem, like drill down to what the problem is that is causing destructive behavior. And so for me, I went on a 3-month journey, and man, it sucked. I wanted to drink so bad, but I had promised Richard and Sherry I would not. And I'd gotten into a VAP, an extensive PTSD program in Wyoming that did this thing called cognitive processing therapy. And it was good. And I went there, and while I was there, they have this program. You identify a destructive thought in your life, like something that's tied to your trauma. And so you go up there and, you know, you won, and then you work on the whole time. And so when I went up there, they're all expecting me to come in, like thought that, you know, 14 guys are dead because of me, because I was in command. I went up there. No, my most destructive thought was I'm damaged and flawed because of my military service that I went and did for our country. Like, I can't be a functional human being anymore because of this. And they were a little shocked. And I said, that's honestly probably where I need to start. And so when I went through that, I kept looking deeper and deeper and deeper. And I finally realized what my problem was. My problem was I didn't get asked to do the job I did in the military because I was such a nice guy. I was asked to do that because I had a capacity to do a job and keep my crap together while I was doing it, while people were dying next to me. That's not normal. And I was promoted and rewarded for it, even worse. And so I just manifested it. And so I essentially realized my problem was my capacity to be an a-hole. And the only thing that could bring that down was the alcohol. But when I started attacking that head on, i.e. just trying to be a nice person, that suppressed it on itself. And man, I never had another desire to drink again. And so as I ran through this destructive thought, I all of a sudden realized that my favorite piece of art in all of history is the Michelangelo David statue. Okay, that statue was supposed to be something else. The marble was harvested. It was supposed to be this bigger piece of art, but it was damaged and flawed, and the emperor told Michelangelo to get rid of it and throw it away. And Michelangelo, in secret, worked on it and worked around the damage and flaws and created what became the Michelangelo statue. And so I all of a sudden realized, what if it's okay that I'm damaged and flawed? And it's that way for a reason. I realized that it was okay that I was damaged and flawed, because being damaged and flawed was going to allow my creator to work around those damage and flaws to create his perfect version of myself, not my perfect version of myself. And that's what I ended up doing. And so
I love that. It's my story is obviously not as intense as yours. But what has led me to who I am today is my flaws, my imperfections, my addictions, my journey to find my purpose, would not have happened without my flaws, and to allow my creator to shape me to what he wants me to be, not what I think everybody else wants me to be, is empowering. It is humbling, and it is gratifying. So I really resonate with what you said there, right there.
Yeah. And so an important thing to that is, like, in order for me to, like, I was searching so hard to get back to what I was when I was at the height of my military career, when I was, you know, company commander, the Ranger Jesse or whatever. That's all I wanted back was Ranger Jesse. And the only way I was going to get that back was if I gave it up. And if I admitted I was damaged and flawed and I was okay with it. And you know what? Through that and through using the Phoenix Project, living life equally on the mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual, I have become a more balanced person that is stronger than I was when I was 27, 28 in most ways. And so, because you learn how to augment, you know, through certain things, and you get creative and you go outside of the box. So that's what happened. And so I got an opportunity to, so I was at that center, USC and Snowboard, had a little incident with the president and Lindsey Vonn. They got in a little Twitter battle. If you look it up, you'll find it. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't know I was in this treatment thing, right? So they call me, being the only military person they know. So I'm in treatment. They come grab me out of class saying that the CEO of USC and Snowboard is on the phone and needs to talk to me. And they thought it was a joke, a prank. And I get on, sure enough, I knew what they were probably calling about. And so I helped them. Like, make a plan. I helped them understand how we look at a president and from the military standpoint. And I helped her understand how, you know, we look at her and how she represents the United States. And I all of a sudden realized I am in treatment right now, essentially. And I'm helping solve, you know, for them a pretty big problem. Mm-hmm. And that's when I realized, you know, maybe Richard was right. There is something that can be, you know, gained from this, from the masses. And so I started getting a little more creative with it. USC and Snowboard invited me out to speak at their partner summit, post Olympics. And I did, it went well. I got invited to do a TED talk. That went okay. And
no, you did great. I've seen it. You did great. But you told me the story behind it all, and there's a lot more to it, but given the circumstances, it was great. That's what led me, to contacting you. I saw, I was like, this dude, I've got to get talk to this dude.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, and really what it comes down to for all those instances that I've been in, and this is probably one of the things I've like learned from Richard a lot too, is all you can do is set the conditions for the best possible outcome that you can have. And then after that, it's just game on. But the person that normally gets what they want is the one that set the conditions for success. And so people will ask me, like, how'd you get to your TED Talk? Well, I got lucky with that, and I'll readily admit that. But I had done a lot of things that when I was in that position, I excelled enough to fool them into me coming and do a TED Talk, right? And so, you know, in life, I've realized that as long as I put the effort for setting the optimal conditions, everything is going to be okay. And it's generally going to work, you know, in my favor. It's at least favorable to me and the people that I care about.
What do you do to set those conditions that enable you to have success? Like, what advice can you offer someone who feels that the world is against them and that there's no change? Like, where do you start?
Yeah, that's awesome, because I've been there. First of all, it's make a plan. And if a plan seems too overwhelming, just take it one day at a time. If one day at a time is too overwhelming, take it 1 hour at a time and just break life into small tasks. And when you can do that, like, life becomes more manageable. And I mean, that's still what I do, is, you know, when I do my planning, it's like, I will start yeah, I'll have my little big plan, but then I'll walk myself back and I'll have all my little plans and I'll just start knocking them out. Because once you can break things down, it's like the concept, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time, right? Or whatever they say, I think that's right. Mm-hmm. But that's the principle is true. Is like, if the task is too big and you're overwhelmed, then step back and make the task smaller.
Yeah, make bite-sized pieces, one step at a time, right? Make some. What I found works is having small goals reaching you towards a big goal. When you achieve those small goals, you see that you're capable of making progress.
So there's a big difference between success and excellence. Okay, so people that are struggling with this area, this is an easy way that they can crush everybody in their way. So, and this is a problem with the athletes we work with, USG and snowboard. So success is the big medal, like the Olympic medal, the podium finishes, flashy stuff, because you have to get those, because that way, otherwise sponsors won't go after you. Success is purely focusing on having that one big run that's going to get you that one medal. Excellence, on the other hand, though, is doing the little things to an extremely high standard over and over and over again, so they become automatic.
In life. New habits.
You can do that.
Yeah, you form new habits. So those habits, you perfect those habits. Well, so it's natural.
And exactly, they're automatic. You know, like look at Duke mm-hmm. basketball. I'm not a huge fan of basketball, but Duke I have a ton of respect for because Coach K, that's his thing. Everybody masters the fundamentals and it works. And I've watched some of the athletes that I've worked with that are doing that and they are skyrocketing ahead of their peers. So everywhere that I've seen this tested, it works. So if you're overwhelmed, pick some little things and become freaking good at them. Not good, excellent. And then all of a sudden, two or three excellent things, small things, become one big victory before you know it.
So that's the difference between an average person and an extraordinary person, is they perfect the little things.
Extraordinary person, all that is, all an extraordinary person is an average person that's not going to go down to meet people where they are at average.
That makes
I'm
me
not, I'm an average guy. I just refuse to go to wherever they say the mean is for being average. And I'm not going to go meet people there. I'm not going to settle. I'm going to go and I'm going to find ways to compensate, mainly through what we just talked about, picking things that I can do very, very, very well over and over and over, repeatable, 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 until they add up and all of a sudden we've got the big victory.
I like that. So I've joked with people before, and when I probably like a lot of people, but I kind of have a hard time accepting compliments. But when I receive one, I'll say, no, I'm not amazing. I'm not great. I just strive to be mediocre. And I have moments where I'm great. And I thought that was kind of a joke. But as you're saying this, I get that's really is my goal, to just be mediocre, be average, and then, but consistently be average.
Yeah.
And if I'm consistently doing that, I'm not backing up. You know,
when I say that I'm average, I always caveat it with, okay, I'm average, but that's my average. It's not my not my job to meet someone else down where their new average is or something like that. And I say that because I want to maintain perspective and I do want to stay humble because that's important. And so it's a double-edged sword there to do with it, but that's my way of doing it. And the thing is, if you keep yourself humble there and if you're still average, well, then you can still grow too, right? You can always get stronger and get better. There's always going to be somebody to beat out there, even if that person is you. So if I'm an average today, that means I can be above average tomorrow, be above average next day, et cetera. Because it's all about beating the person I was today, tomorrow. That's tomorrow's goal. And beat Richard Bell in golf. But
so as you're talking about Richard Bell, and as you've talked to him about him to me.
He taught me everything I know in golf. So right, it's not really, like, it's not fair to even say that.
But if you could describe him in one word, what would you use?
Remarkable.
No.
You don't get to pick. You don't get to pick your own word for other people. So I have one word in mind. I want to see if we have the same one.
How would you describe Richard Bell? Not knowing him at all other than what I tell you.
The word that I would use is compassionate.
Okay, we were pretty damn close. I was going to say unconditional love. But compassionate is actually, we were you were closer than I gave you credit for, my friend. Why? Because I've answered that a couple of times. People look at me like,
oh, have you?
Use the word love, Jesse. But, you know, Richard was the guy that, so he showed me unconditional love during that time leading up into Amishary. They were the only ones that showed me unconditional love. And that was how I was able to get to that point, to have that vision of the Phoenix Project. And then after that, I was scared that Amishary would smack me if I messed it up. So
I would use the term dumbass, but.
Yeah, I just didn't want to let him down.
Yeah. So the reason why I say the word compassionate, and it's similar along the lines, it's, when you have compassion for someone, I think those words are kind of synonymous, right? At times. But what I understand compassion to mean is seeing a need to alleviate someone else's suffering and compelled to help. And I think that that requires unconditional love.
Yeah, that was, so he just met me down in LA for an undisclosed activity. We'll say I can't talk too much about it, but he flew into LA to meet with some people that I still don't think they really know why they're meeting with me, but it was fun regardless. And as we were talking, that was kind of what got brought out in the story, because they were asking, talk about your role with Jesse and, why did you stay by him? You know, most people probably would have quit. I mean, everyone else had. He's the only one that hadn't quit. And so I like to think he spotted talent, but and he wasn't going to give up on it. It's like his number one draft pick. No, not so much. I mean, I do think that was part of it though. Like, I think there was a little part of me, like what I was able, the ideas that I was able to come up with to like get out of trouble and stuff like that, and like, and come up with solutions to like just crazy ideas, I think Richard found like interesting, and that kept him entertained a little bit. And like, maybe if we put a couple of these together, like something will actually add up eventually down the road. And I think that's what has happened. Because, you know, Richard and Sherry, they own several businesses, and it was all around talent management, like acquisition, like finding talent. And so, you know, he will never admit it, but that's my theory. And hopefully someday I'll be able to get Sherry to admit that to me.
Do you think it's possible for everyone to have someone like that in their life?
Yeah, I do.
Find someone, or do you think you were lucky?
Yes, I was blessed. Okay, but here's the thing.
It's a better word.
Yeah. So, you know, I never had a father. I mean, I love my dad. And my dad and I have been able to come back together and understand that we both did the best we could, like growing up, right? I mean, he has something to deal with my biological mother, let me tell you what. And I have forgiven him. And, you know, and I've said things to him in the past that he's forgiven me for. But I never had a dad. And to me, a dad was this interesting combination of a mentor, a friend, a teacher, you know, a confidant, someone that did at least one thing better than you. So when Richard and I met, he played golf better than me. So it was all these things. And I'd never had that relationship before, and I wanted it. And I wanted it so bad that I almost destroyed my dad and I's potential at a relationship. And Richard was the one that helped me to understand, Jesse, you can't make your father be someone that he's not. That's unfair of you. And that's what he'd always tell me when I'd call him and be frustrated and not understand. And, you know, I suddenly realized that, you know, that's what Richard was for me, especially during that time when I needed that role so bad. He was that for me. So I had it as a desire leading up to there. And had I not had that as a desire, I wouldn't have been receptive to that when it came up. And so I kept my heart open just enough. So in terms of how this applies to real life, regular life. if there's something that you want in life, figure out what that is and make sure that you're setting conditions that when it comes to you, you're ready to receive it. Because that's people's biggest problem, I think, is that the one thing they're looking for comes, but they're not ready to receive it. So they often don't see it, or it just passes them right on by.
Why do you think sometimes we're not ready to receive it? Do you think that's the expectation? We expect it to come packaged differently, or
no, the or biggest problem say? Is because people are lazy and they're not willing to do the work, because things that are important okay. take work.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a level of vulnerability that's required to receive it too. And that's what you're talking about. Like you leaving your heart open just a little bit.
Yeah. And the level of vulnerability that I had was immense. Most people that would see it with Richard Nye, they wouldn't recognize it. I think he did. And I did. And I'm definitely a lot better than I was in the past. But I had set these conditions, you know, in the past. And then when the opportunity, when I needed it, he was there, I received it, and it ended up being a catalyst for the change that I was able to make in my life. And that's why, you know, that's why I asked him to narrate my book. Because I can't think of a better way for him to be remembered by his grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, than to have that to listen to. And that's my way of honoring him and for his journey in this. And, you know, in honoring Miss Sherry through honoring him, you know, that way. Because Miss Sherry, you know, she's an incredible Texas woman. And, you know, she has been supportive of Richard and Ryan and Robert and me. Like, this woman has sacrificed so much. And she's the one going through cancer right now. It's like the universe doesn't make sense. And it sucks. So I can either feel sorry for her about it, or I can step up and try and do what I can to take some of the pressure off her plate. Set the conditions for success in the future. Most people just want to complain about how things are not going to happen in the future.
Yeah. That they wishes
make them happen.
I just wanted a spot in the book. That's it. I just wanted a role in the book.
He went through a lot of work to get it, so I think he earned it.
Yeah, well, some people are dumber than others.
Yeah, I love your guys' relationship.
Yeah, and the other thing too is, you know, I didn't have a family, right? For most part. But what I have had the opportunity to do, and this is something anyone can do. Like if you're out there and you're complaining, oh, I don't have a family, my family sucks, you know, blah, 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 blah. Okay, I challenge you to do this. Why not curate your own family? Because that's what I did with Richard and Sherry. Now, are they perfect? Well, Miss Sherry's close. But you know, they're not. Everybody has their challenges. But, you know, I've chosen to curate that. And I mean, it's amazing. And we have an awesome thing going. And I'm excited that they're going to be a part of, you know, my future life.
What does it mean to you to live a good life?
What does it mean? Okay, that's easy too. Never leave anything on the table at the end of the day. Like if you, or anything you do, if you go and do something and you look back and you're like, I gave 60% and I left some gas on the table. That is failure to me. Because I didn't give it all my effort, or I didn't put in the appropriate effort. So like, let's say that I'm doing a chore for Miss Sherry at the house while she's struggling from chemo and I only give 60% effort. Well, I just left 40% on the table because she wasn't good enough for that 40%. So why would I not, you know, put the full effort in or whatnot? And I say that because looking at high-performing individuals, mainly U.S. ski and snowboard, and then some other, you know, communities I've gotten to work with in the military, the difference between winning and being on the podium for second, third, and fourth is one thing. The person that left the most on the table is in fourth. Mm. You know, for me, that's a successful day. And my athletes I work with, you know, they're judged by people. People have emotions, people have feelings, people have preconceived notions. I don't care what they get in the standings. All I care is if they went into that half pipe every day or every competition and they left nothing on the table. Because even if they did get first, second, or third, and they left something on the table, they did not push to a new level that that Japanese rider is pushing himself to. So what good is that first place at Toyota Grand Prix if you go to the Olympics and you get your clock cleaned? That's why you can't afford to leave anything on the table.
That leads great up right into my next question for you. So yeah. The name of this show is Metal Mentality. What does it mean to you to have a metal mentality?
So I've kind of cheated because I've listened to the the podcast. So I will do my best not to game this answer. But I already kind of have one. It's okay to suffer. That is probably the biggest problem, in my opinion, with our country right now. Is people are afraid to suffer. They're afraid to struggle. They're afraid to be uncomfortable. Now, you don't want to put yourself in painful situations. That's not smart. But it's okay to embrace the suck a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's okay to put yourself in uncomfortable situations. Like you, for example. You know, you shared with me that, you know, your main reason for starting the podcast was because it was something a little uncomfortable for you. You want to get outside of your element. That's good. That forces people to grow. And what it also does is it forces that douchebag next to you to step up his game too. Well, what happens if everybody in a group starts stepping up their game? The whole team gets better. The whole country gets better, right? And so that's what that does. But when everybody's just operating, because we could go in the gym together and I'm making a wild assumption that I might bench press a little bit more than you, but I could be wrong. If I go in there and let's say I can do 225 10 times, and you can only do 135 10 times, but we go slap 185 on the bar and I knock out 10 times and you do it one or two or three, who's done more work? The answer is you.
Yeah. Because,
and those are the worst people, right? The people that do have a capacity for something, but they never push themselves past it.
It's not afraid to quit. So to you, metal mentality means it's okay to suffer.
It's look for the suffering. That's what's gonna help you grow, is putting yourself in uncomfortable situations. That is a metal mentality for me.
So I made an assumption about you. I thought you were gonna answer something different. I like that though.
There you go.
But I think that it means that's why I asked that question, is because it means something different to all of us. If you were embracing that suck, you're being the best version of yourself that you can during that situation. And if you're looking for that opportunity, you're leaving nothing on the table. So I would say it's more so, because my answer to this question and has evolved for me as well, that it means to not only embrace the suck of life and accept the fact that you're going to suffer and using that to grow, but to get through that, it's going to require you to be the best version of yourself consistently. You do that is by leaving nothing on the table.
Yep. The fire sharpens the iron, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you want to grow, go get hot.
Yeah.
It's going to happen.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, absolutely. What are you most proud of in your life?
What am I most proud of in my life? So the book answer is my daughters. Right? My two daughters. That's what I'm most proud of. In fact, the bottom of my bio, you'll see my two greatest accomplishments for those two little girls. And I do stand by that. But what I am most proud of is the fact that I have kept this going for as long as it has, and it keeps getting stronger. Because there was a point where there was nothing that getting my Ranger tab could eclipse. Or it could be better than that. And I remember when I hit 1 year of continuous abstaining from alcohol, that was a big deal to me. And I actually compared it, because at the time, none of my friends had made the decision to do that. And so I actually said, when I got it, when I hit 1 year, I said, this is a bigger deal to me than getting my Ranger tab, which is pretty much heresy in that community to say anything. Yeah. Else. But it was, and it's continued to be, And people will hear me say that and they'll kind of shrug it off initially, but this has been harder than Ranger School in some ways, but it's been more rewarding too. The results mm-hmm. that I get out of it and my capacity to do things on the back end is beyond description.
Yeah. Everything in life that has a big reward is hard. Harder the effort, the greater the reward. And I get my kids are my greatest accomplishment too. And they're probably one of the hardest things I've ever done. But the self growth and development that comes from trying to become a better version of Preston for them.
So that's what I was coming to is that I want to be a dad they're proud of when they're walking down that aisle, because they're going to look back at this times, hopefully, and say, wow, you know what? Dad really kept his crap together. He didn't only hold his crap together. He grew and thrived through it. Mm-hmm. And that provides them something to then catapult off of.
Yeah. I think that every mediocre father, that's their goals. They want their kids to, they want to be someone that their kids are proud of. And I think what separates a mediocre parent from an excellent parent is not only do their kids say that about them, but they teach their children how to be awesome, how to consistently be mediocre and do great things.
So, you know, it's funny you say that, because like with Richard and Sherry, for example, like you have no idea how important it is for Sherry to be proud of me. Like I will make these dinners that just blow her mind. Like, and I didn't even start cooking until like 2 or 3 years ago. But I did it because like I want to like make her proud of me, and cooking is not something that would normally come as, you know, natural to me. And so I get that. And it's interesting, like even now today, like Sherry and I and Richard and I have that relationship still. And so I get it. And 100% true.
Yeah. So I want to go back. I like that a lot, by the way. I really like wanting to make the people we love the most proud of us. That there's something to be said about that, that you want them to be proud of who you are because you love them. You don't want to disappoint. But it's also going to be dangerous because we can do things only for that reason. But what I found in my recovery and getting to where I'm at today, which is I'm still on my journey, is I've learned that you can only do it for yourself. If you're doing anything for anyone else, you can only last for so long.
100%. Yep. We're in complete agreement. And there's a brief period of time that got me to Wyoming where, you know, Richard and Sherry were the ones I was doing it for. Mm-hmm. And that was unfair of me to put them on that pedestal. But at the time that was what I needed. And I knew I was going to have a, you know, 3 months of protection essentially to kind of let that go. But yes, it's 100% right. And you know, it's not about like, obviously my existence doesn't go away if they're not proud of me for doing something, but like, I know what it means to them for them to feel proud of me. It's a big deal because for them, they've lost, you know, that kind of thing because their kids are grown up and all this stuff. And now all of a sudden they kind of have like this really interesting, weird second shot, you know, of life. And I think we've kind of joked around it a couple times, but it's true. And I have a second chance to learn how to, you know, how to have a healthy relationship with a woman, for example. That is something Ms. Sherry has given me that I never thought I would have the opportunity for. And I think, you know, my future bride, that's going to pay big, huge dividends. And if I would have had this relationship with Sherry, I probably wouldn't have been ready for her.
Wow. It's powerful. What I'm hearing you say is that they mean so much to you here that it's kind of an opportunity for you to share how much they mean to you today by having them here.
For
them to hear it. And I think that's really cool. That you have a relationship with them, one, to do that. And the other thing I find really impressive is the fact that that's important too. that they know that how much you love them.
We just hope he doesn't screw it up.
Yeah. Spoken like a true father.
I have to execute. Here's the thing. You still got to execute for the people you love.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. There are no participation trophies here in this house right now. Execute.
Absolutely.
Everybody else can do whatever they want.
So if we cannot live our lives defined by our achievements, how should we live our lives?
You know, if your brand or identity is in your achievements, what you do, any of that stuff, if that gets taken away from you, you're toast. Same thing. Mm-hmm. So these plaques are part of me. They're part of my history. They're part of my journey. And I acknowledge them. But I'm not that journey. I was for a long time. But I'm not that journey of that plaque over there that's got 49 purple hearts on it and 5 silver stars and all that crap. That's not what I'm defined by. I had an opportunity to be a part of that that helped mold the person that I am today. So the stuff, you can let it help mold you and shape you. But where people go wrong is where that is their shape, is that stuff.
So how do you define yourself?
How do I define myself? Mm-hmm. I define myself as a guy that I don't have anything to lose, man. I really don't. And I set the conditions that I can go in and that's the way I feel. I mean, I do. I set the conditions for safeguard, you know, out the, you know what, but like I should have died so many times. I had my first malfunction as a cadet in college with a parachute. My truck got blown off a bridge. In fact, we didn't tell that story. Ryan came and rescued me at the hospital. My truck, 2 weeks into our deployment, the first deployment, my truck got blown off a bridge. I went down with it and spent 4 minutes underwater. The Humvee was on top of me, on top of my head. And my night vision goggles went right back in my eyes, and I spent a few days in a coma. Thought I died. Like, I went through the whole asphyxiation thing. I thought about the last three things, and I was done. I had the suicide bomber blow up 15 feet from me in 2007 when I got peppered down the left side of my body. I am very lucky to be alive. And I realize that. And every day that I live is truly a gift for me, because I shouldn't have these. After everything that I went through, 2.5 years ago, I almost killed myself with my just lifestyle. What the heck? Why did I let myself do that, given all the grace of God that I had up to that point? So what that means for a guy like me is, man, I got to earn every day that I have, because it is a gift. And so when you look at life like, hey, I get to do today, then it's a lot different, you know? And well, I get to do something not, I got to go to the DMV today. That was horrible. But I ended up having a great 30-minute conversation, and I think the guy probably laughed more than he'd ever laughed. His name was Theo. And you know, I made that horrible situation into something actually decent. So it's, I would say that's, and yeah, I think there's ways you can get to that mindset without having gone through near-death, you know, experiences either. Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't the near-death experiences that got me there. It's me realizing that I wasted it that did.
So you're a guy that has nothing to lose, is not going to, but not going to waste any opportunity. Exactly. You're going to leave nothing on the table. I like that.
So the nothing to lose thing is that's so you can continue going. You essentially like the no fear, like you're not going to fear anything. You're going to go for it. Now you do have to fear things. You have to set, you know, safety boundaries and all that stuff. Listen, when I'm riding with those snowboarders, I have to do a little internal safety brief. Okay. I can't just fly down with them the way they do. And I've tried and it's not going to end well, but I can set all those conditions and then I send it, man. And I let it fly. And it's like, that's my attitude in life. Set your conditions set your path, make sure safeguards are in place, but after that, go. And that's what I've done since I was young, and it's worked well for me, and now it's continued to.
It's pretty cool that you're willing to open up and share your experience like this, because a lot of people aren't. And I think that says a lot about who you are.
I have a lot of making up to do in this life. I took for granted a lot of things, and I got away with a lot of things. I'm very lucky to be here. I'm lucky that my body is the way that it is, how I treated it. And every day is a gift for me. So, and the biggest thing that I would ever want to give other people is for them to get to that point where they feel the same way. It's pretty awesome.
Thank you so much for your time today. You're an awesome guy. You're incredibly caring and compassionate. And that is the perfect point for us to continue this on the next episode or in the future.
Hey guys, be sure to follow the Metal Mentality Podcast on social media. And as always, if you find value in the show, please leave a review and rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. But more importantly, share this podcast with someone you know who would benefit from the messages from the guests on each episode. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter @MetalMentality.